Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest OIES podcast. This one's being brought to you from the GAS programme. My name is James Henderson. I'm head of GAS research at the Institute. And with me today is Professor Jonathan Stern, a former head of the GAS programme and a writer of many of the papers that have been published over the past 20 years. And indeed, that's why we're here today, because 20 years ago this month, Jonathan walked into the Institute in Oxford for the first time and started the GAS programme. And so we're going to have a special edition today in which we review some of the key themes that the GAS programme has covered over the past 20 years and kind of reflect on the state of the GAS market today. I'll just date this podcast. We're recording on the 6th of October, just in case we say anything completely up to date. But without further ado, Jonathan, welcome to this special edition of the podcast.
Thanks, Jim. Looking forward to it.
Well, let's look back at 20 years and reflect a little. I mean, when you walked into the Institute 20 years ago, did you really think we'd be talking after two decades about the GAS programme at Oxford Institute for Energy Studies?
Absolutely not. I didn't really know what the future would hold. And when I looked at the website a couple of days ago and discovered, you know, we've got 25 research fellows, we're on 184 natural gas papers, apart from what other things we've published. You know, if you told me that when we in October 2003, I would have thought it was somewhat fanciful.
Nevertheless, here we are today. So let's have a little look back then at some of the key themes and hopefully how they impact the market still today. I want to start with something that I guess was pretty current when you walked into the Institute, which was the liberalisation of the EU gas market. I mean, what are your reflections on how that process all happened and what the impact over the past 20 years has been?
I think it was much anticipated that the market would liberalise, really on two levels. Firstly, the various directives and regulations from Brussels, which we were grinding very slowly. And secondly, the commercial developments, which were moving much faster. And we really covered that on two levels. Firstly, individual countries, the books by Heiko Lohmann on Germany, but also the battle on oil-linked gas pricing, particularly with Sergei Komlev of Gazprom Export. And then on a very specific level, the papers on the evolution of hubs and exchanges, of course, starting with NBP, which Patrick Heather authored and continues to author. But the real key moment, I think, was the development of almost a tidal wave of opinion that Europe had to move away from oil-linked gas pricing and towards hub pricing. And that was a huge issue for us. And then, of course, followed by all of the contractual issues and the arbitrations in the late 2000s and early 2010s. So that was really a very big feature of our work for most of the first 5 or maybe even 10 years.
And of course, the strategy behind that whole liberalisation process was to, you know, allow customers across the European Union, across Europe almost, to have access to competitive prices. When you look back, do you think that the process, A, worked, and B, you know, encouraged greater demand for gas in Europe?
The process definitely worked, much against the strictures of the main gas companies at that time. Of course, the UK had moved in that direction before everyone else. But the question of gas demand, I think that was the thing that really surprised. I mean, the work that Anouk Honoré was doing on gas demand at the time was, I think, really important, but not even that anticipated just what a huge increase in gas demand we would get. Nobody really got anything right about price levels and how prices would fall and then stay relatively low and steady, a big contrast to the recent past. But I mean, we were in uncharted territory, and I think the industry was as well. You know, we attended, like everyone else, all these conferences where people were asked, well, what do you think? Do you think hub pricing is going to be a success? And in general, I would say by the time we got to 2011, it was very clear that this was now going to be an unstoppable force. But again, I don't think anyone anticipated how quickly this would happen once it got going.
You mentioned Anik's research on demand. I mean, reflect a little bit for us on demand in the various sectors in Europe and how that really kind of surged. I mean, power generation, I'm thinking of particularly, and industry too.
I mean, we saw an increase in power generation, but I mean, what we hadn't, I think, again, realised was how this would come together with the early transition indicators, the phase out of coal, and then, of course, the issues around nuclear power, not necessarily a transition issue, post-Fukushima, and all kinds of things that appeared to be just making the world of gas set fair. The kind of agreement, albeit on a rather loose basis, that coal to gas switching was the way forward, that gas is, and certainly was considered, but still considered by many, to be the answer to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The phase out of coal, both in power and in industry, was tremendously important. And a sense that, you know, there'd been a feeling in the 2000s that, okay, gas was fine, but where were we going to get this from? Was there enough gas around to fulfill all the things that we thought we might want to do with it in Europe? And that, of course, meant that the focus came together on Russian gas because, as people now reflect with most recent developments, but didn't so much reflect at the time, we could get access to very large quantities of Russian gas through new pipelines, whereas we were still extremely interested in LNG, and there was an LNG story evolving that we may talk about later, but it was still thought to be, well, you know, we can't compete with Asia for LNG, so it's always going to be limited. We really weren't at the transition issues like what about other gases like hydrogen and biomethane. That was still very much a minority sport until we got to very much the latter part of the 2010s.
So you've mentioned Sergei Komarev, who you famously had quite a few battles with over oil-linked pricing and its role in the market. But, I mean, which brings us really to Gazprom and the role of Russian gas. I mean, it was interesting, was it not, how strongly they opposed any move away from long-term contracts tied to oil prices. And yet, once they did move away, they found a ready market for their gas and grew their market share very rapidly. I mean, how do you reflect on the role of Russian gas in Europe over the 20-year period?
What's really, I think, very interesting is that right through this period, the same concerns about security continued to be voiced by a lot of the same people and the same politicians in Europe. But what happened that I think people didn't understand was that the opposition from Gazprom, particularly Gazprom Export, and even Putin himself, was at a very high level. In the first 5 years of the 2010s, I was the EU speaker for the EU-Russia Gas Advisory Council. What was very fascinating there was that there were a few, shall we say, senior people from Gazprom and the government who trotted out the party line. But the younger people, the younger generation, who were Western educated, had spent time with companies in Europe, had sat in trading rooms, in the coffee breaks were like, we can do this. This is not a problem for us. You know, we think we'll do pretty well here. We understand how to do this. And when I heard that, I thought, okay, so is this just a party line? And in fact, what we'll find is that as time goes on, they will figure this out and begin to really head for the trading floors. And that's exactly what happened. I wouldn't say that I completely anticipated the electronic sales platform and the enthusiasm for it within Gazprom Export. And I recall very much a meeting that you and I had in St. Petersburg towards the beginning of that platform where we asked about it. And it was very much, oh, well, it's not really terribly important. It's just a few youngsters doing a bit of trading. We're like, okay, it looks to us like this is going to become a big deal, which, of course, it did until the events that we all know about.
Just as we sort of bring things up to date, I mean, so Gazprom worked out that it could trade, it could compete, it had some very low cost competitive gas, and if offered in the right way, customers would buy it, which they clearly did. On reflection, do you think that customers in Europe were naive in the way they basically just bought as much Russian gas as they could? And were politicians naive? Or was it just a function of the market at the time and no one could really anticipate what happened next?
I think it was a function of the market at the time, and nobody really understood, including most of the politicians that were against this and most of the people in Brussels, nobody really understood that when the market liberalised, there wouldn't be any stopping Russian gas if Russian gas was competitive. Just as people now talk about, oh, the Russians weaponised gas storage by not refilling in 2001, seemingly not understanding that there was no obligation to do that. No, this is a liberalised market and gas players were doing what was in their commercial interest. Of course, subsequently, we discovered this had a strong political overtones from Moscow. But at the time, I don't think anybody quite realised what the consequences of liberalisation would be. But even before that, one thing that, again, I don't see in the commentary about the history, and possibly that's because some of us who lived through the history saw this very clearly, that there was no great keenness to increase the share of Russian gas in Europe. It was absolutely not that either companies or politicians were saying, oh, you know, Putin's a great guy. We can rely on this person. We don't have any concerns about increasing our dependence. No, they had tried really strongly to develop other sources of gas. So we need to talk here about also the completely unforeseen, almost shutdown of Dutch gas exports, which started at that time. And we also need to talk about the fact that there was a really strong impact on the expectation from the so-called Southern Corridor. Don't forget, in the early 2000s, we were talking about a three-pipeline corridor carrying 100 billion cubic metres from Central Asia, the Middle East and the Caspian region. Never really happened, still hasn't happened even to this day. So it's not that everyone wanted Russian gas and walked into this blindly. It was a combination of the fact that most other sources hadn't worked out, or at least not in any significant volume, and liberalisation made it easy and completely logical to import more Russian gas.
That's fascinating. And I think, you know, the concept of this sort of becoming a more global market and looking for alternative sources of supply kind of brings us on to LNG, which you've already mentioned, but also the other growing market for gas, or the other big importing region, which is Asia. And that kind of, you mentioned the kind of competition between Europe and Asia for LNG, which for a long time, Asia was just seen as winning because it was prepared to pay a premium price. Talk to us a little bit about gas in Asia over this 20-year period and how it's really moved on from where it was back in 2003.
Well, again, we did a couple of books on Asian gas in the 2000s that we'll read very strangely now because essentially we didn't anticipate that gas would become such an, and particularly LNG would become such an important fuel. And when we did, you know, our books on some individual countries, we looked at what we thought might happen. But again, we did not anticipate the impact of transition in Asia, which has not produced an enormous impetus from civil society for the development for reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. But the decision to switch from coal, mainly for local environmental reasons, is really very important. And again, the sudden availability of LNG from a variety of new sources, and obviously one's thinking here about North America post the shale revolution, that development was completely unforeseen. But we focused increasingly on Asia and obviously China, but also the traditional Asian LNG importers. We focused on them. We also tried to focus on India, which for us has been, in terms of gas and LNG, something of a disappointment, although the promise is still there. But it's clear that with the development of the transition in Europe, Asia is going to be the place where at least unabated gas and unabated LNG can still increase. And that, I think, is something that the whole global gas industry has focused on, particularly in the last 5 years.
And of course, the rise of gas demand in Asia has brought with it the rise of LNG, which you've mentioned you know, the surge in demand for LNG as a form of gas delivered particularly to markets not connected by pipeline has been phenomenal. How do you reflect on that? I mean, driven by the Asian market, but then picked up elsewhere in the world?
That's correct. But the other thing that's really important is, I mean, there are so few gas, international gas pipelines now proposed and under construction. The only ones that are really in Asia, the big ones are from China, from Russia to China. And how international gas pipeline trade has become really unpopular, mainly for political reasons. And this was happening way before the Russia-Ukraine war and the cessation or dramatic reduction of deliveries to Europe. This is then accompanied by a real decrease in the cost of delivering LNG. That's both the hardware and then, of course, in terms of North America, the cost of the gas itself. So suddenly, large-scale LNG became mainstream in a way that I would say at the start of the program, certainly in the 2000s, the slogan was, well, you know, you've got to be very rich already to want to get richer in the LNG business. It was regarded as a real high-cost business for rich countries.
You've touched on the US already, but I mean, what would I be right in saying that one of the big transformations in the LNG industry around cost as well has been the development of US shale, which obviously transformed the US market, turned it from a potential importer of LNG to an exporter, and also the different price mechanism, the kind of based on Henry Hub plus, that has had a major impact on the LNG market as well. Would that be right?
I think that's exactly right. And I think the other thing is how wrong most commentators got this at the start of the shale revolution. I mean, for the first almost 10 years, everybody was saying, well, yeah, it can go on for a little while, but basically it's going to fizzle out and then prices are going to go up in the US. And of course, the other switch, which was from the US as an LNG importer, with terminals having been built in the 2000s for what was forecast to be a shortage in the US, to the US not just being self-sufficient, but becoming obviously the potential for exports, which really changed the picture entirely. And we just never really foresaw the scale of US LNG and the fact that even when the scale became enormous, the costs and therefore US gas prices remained down at $2 to $3 for long periods of time, even though just occasionally you'd get a spike. But this is something that really, again, has transformed the global gas and particularly the global LNG market.
I mean, before we move on, we should sort of say it was interesting how US shale transformed the market, but it hasn't really worked anywhere. Argentina, perhaps, it hasn't really worked anywhere else. I mean, I think we wrote a little bit about the UK and how it hasn't worked here, but in, you know, Europe, China to an extent, but I mean, US shale has really been the standout marker, if you like, for that form of gas.
Well, North America, really, because we shouldn't rule out Canada for their shale success. But I think one of our successes was that, and I recall this paper really well, we published a paper in December 2010 at the height of what one might call European shale extremism, where actually whole conferences were being held and the future of European shale gas and how the US experiment and experience could be repeated here. And we essentially poured cold water on it and said, no, it won't happen here and it won't happen for a variety of reasons, but partly because you won't have the social license to operate that you do in North America. And people kind of, I don't want to say attacked us, but people criticized us on the basis of, oh, well, you guys are just pessimists. You're happy to see Russian gas carry on in Europe. This is an opportunity to become independent of Russian gas. Of course, there was a lot of other issues apart from the social license, which was the geology didn't turn out to be as good as a lot of people had expected, particularly in Poland, where enough wells were drilled. In a number of other countries, there weren't enough wells drilled really even to test the geology. But I mean, I suppose I would reflect on that by saying I was a shale skeptic, but if you had told me that by the end of the 2010s, there would be virtually no shale gas being developed in Europe. I would have said, well, I think that's a bit pessimistic. So the failure was much more extreme than I expected.
Indeed. But let's come back then to the US, where obviously it was a dramatic success, has been and continues to be a dramatic success, with now the result that there's a surplus of gas and gas is being exported via LNG. And let's come up to the current day and reflect a little bit on the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the dramatic decline in Russian exports, pipeline exports to Europe, and the reversal of Europe's role as really the balancing market for LNG to being a major competitor of LNG and US LNG being one of the main sources of supply now. How do you reflect on the impact of the 2022 crisis, energy crisis, and initially, let's stick with natural gas, on flows of natural gas and how that's impacted the global market?
Well, I mean, it has been an extraordinary time and one that's been difficult to chronicle for a research programme because of very, very fast moving events. So basically, I think few of us imagined that something as disastrous as the Russia-Ukraine war would happen. Secondly, I think if we'd been told that it would happen, we would have said there would be a massive gas crisis in Europe. When it happened, we anticipated a massive gas crisis. All right, we were somewhat fortunate in Europe because of the weather and a number of other things that went in our favour. Of course, there was a huge price crisis with prices reaching unimaginable levels. But the ability of both governments and companies to build new infrastructure in months, infrastructure that you would have imagined and indeed historically would have taken years to even get permits for, let alone actually build, was very impressive. I guess what we should say was that in other parts of the world, this was not appreciated as floating LNG was taken away from countries which were much less able to purchase at the kind of prices that were around in Europe. But the switch from Russian pipeline gas to LNG was extraordinary. And I think probably will be when the history of gas in Europe is written by people will be held up as the ability of governments and companies to move incredibly quickly when a crisis dictated and when there were real fears that curtailments of not just industrial and power generation customers, but possibly also of residential customers were threatened in EU countries.
I mean, two more reflections I'd like to touch on. Firstly, it was remarkable how the price spiked and yet came back down to what we might regard as reasonable levels around $10 an MMBTU. I mean, high by the 5-year historical average, but pretty reasonable in a sort of long-term perspective. How rapidly that happened. I mean, I guess there was, as you've mentioned, an element of luck in that, but also market rebalancing. Second point, you mentioned how fast governments reacted and whether that, you know, that government intervention is going to become a theme now for the market. I mean, obviously we've had price caps, we've had joint purchasing mechanisms. You know, so the speed of the turnaround, but also the government intervention. How do you reflect on that for the future?
You know, I mean, there's lots of things to say about this. But I think the big picture is I wonder whether this will actually impact significantly on the liberalisation of the market that we spent 30 years trying to do and successfully doing throughout Europe. If governments are going to decide a lot more things about how the market is organised, that is going to put pressure on the liberalisation developments and particularly freedom to decide what gas to buy and where to buy it from. But the other thing that I think is interesting is that there was, particularly in Brussels and in a number of continental European countries, in 2022, and still in some places, a feeling that the market's failed, these are not market prices, companies are profiteering, we should intervene and place price caps on the wholesale market. I think, you know, we and others very much pointed out that actually the market was accurately reflecting what supply-demand, the supply-demand balance, And all the complaints were about the fact that actually there was too little supply and too much demand, even though demand was declining. We'll see how that plays out. But I think the obviously massive achievement was the creation of these hubs and the fact that during the crisis, they were high, which is extremely high, which you would expect. And after the crisis, they went down. And I would expect that as we move on into 2025, 26, we'll see prices go back to much more normal historical levels. But it will be interesting to see whether governments and the European Commission actually agree with that, or whether they are tempted to intervene further. Because, as completely understandably, governments get terribly, terribly anxious about a security crisis, which actually does not only caused gas to become unaffordable for certain customer groups, but also the possibility that actually physically you wouldn't be able to deliver gas to important political groups, because governments know that this is something that voters take very, very seriously.
So while we're on the topic of government policy and intervention, we should talk about the role of gas and the future role of gas, not just in Europe, but across the world. Let's start with Europe, though. Of course, the EU responded to the crisis last year by doubling down, if you like, on the pace of the energy transition, Repower EU. How do you see the role of gas in the transition in Europe? And then how do you see it differently in other parts of the world?
When this started, the gas industry as a whole simply kept repeating coal to gas switching is the way forward. You need to phase out coal. You need to replace it with gas. And this will fix a lot of your greenhouse gas emission target problems. And the UK actually demonstrated that. You know, most of the gains in the UK came from the phase out of very, very old and inefficient coal stations that probably should have been phased out a long time ago, and replaced them with gas-fired power stations and then renewables. But the problem for the gas industry was this was a tune that they continue to try and play for far too long, when they're actually being told, yeah, we understand that, but that's not good enough. We want to reduce unabated gas and replace it with either renewables or low or zero carbon gases. Now, I'm going to say that's Europe, but actually that is the richer countries in Europe. The extent to which you go south and east in Europe, you will find that to be not such a big priority, particularly for countries which have still quite big coal shares in their energy balances. But if we move outside Europe, it's actually interesting how, and this is where what you find at conferences, particularly international conferences, even international gas conferences, never mind energy, that I don't want to say the rest of the world cares less about the energy transition. But what I would say is that it's actually very difficult to find countries where the energy transition and greenhouse gas targets are as high up the agenda as they are in the more wealthy European countries. In the US, of course, we've got Biden and the IRA, which is an amazing achievement and an amazing initiative for climate change. But as we look around the rest of the world, you know, Australia with the more recent government, yes, some smaller countries, definitely. But if we look at the big countries in Asia, the places where energy demand is already going up very significantly, it's not that they don't care about this, but their targets are, shall we say, less ambitious. And you don't feel that compared with development as a priority, transition ranks very high. And the more you go to places in Africa, you feel like that as well. It's a broad generalization. But for me, the European enthusiasm, correct in my view, on greenhouse gas reduction and phasing out of unabated fossil fuels is really unique in terms of its enthusiasm and also its voter support.
And so the EU is also leading on another topic that is kind of close to your heart, you know, emissions from the value chain of hydrocarbons, in this instance, gas, and you've written about the emissions in the value chains of LNG. Methane emissions is something you focused on, but I think GHG emissions more generally you've also talked about. What are your thoughts on the credibility of gas as part of the transition, given questions that are being asked about emissions in the value chain?
I have to say I'm a slightly disappointed person because I've worked on this now for 3 or 4 years. And 2 years ago, I was very much more hopeful and enthusiastic that the results would be quick and that the response from both governments and the corporate sector would be appropriate and much more vigorous. Now, you can say, and I think it's right to say, that the energy crisis that we've talked about has to some extent set back all environmental legislation because the agendas and the priorities of governments have been to focus on what to do about that crisis. I think that is now beginning to blow over, and there's a refocus on environmental issues and particularly targets and how governments are going to meet the targets that they've signed up to. The problem really in terms of methane and the gas industry is that we've seen a lot of initiatives and pledges and roadmaps signed by a lot of important countries and a lot of important politicians. But, you know, one of the things that is very clear is we don't have any detail. We don't have any transparency about what is actually happening. We have very little data. We have very little information on methodology. And without that, it's very easy for NGOs and indeed the public at large to dismiss this as fossil fuel greenwash. The industry has got to do an awful lot better of actually persuading the civil society that it is not just serious in terms of its declarations, but it's serious in terms of its actions. And just to give you, important issue that I think is that maybe people who haven't followed it don't really understand. You know, the Global Methane Pledge, it's a great initiative signed in Glasgow. It's got 150 signatories, but the signatories do not include China, India, Russia, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, very important parts of the world haven't signed up to this. And we look at the Oil and Gas Methane Partnership 2.0. Again, excellent document by the industry, lots of commitments. 113 or so companies have signed up to achieve these standards. 100 of them are from the US and the EU. 2 of them are in Asia. 1 is in Africa. 3 are in the Middle East. So you get a feeling that basically we've got an awful long way to go, despite the fact that on a declaratory level, you know, we're saying all the right things.
Okay, that's a slightly depressing note. So let's try and end on something slightly more positive. The IEA have released their kind of most recent forecasts for the WEO, and they have downgraded their expectations for gas going forward. What are your reflections now, 20 years on, about the future of gas? Are you still an optimist in terms of demand for gas growing and supply being available? Or do you think we've now reached the kind of peak of gas's role in the global energy mix, and that we're going to see decline from here?
I think really, let me just reflect on the IEA, because people like me have been peer reviewing the WEO for what seems like decades as well. Again, when I hear the commentary on IEA net zero, I still think that a large part of the audience doesn't understand what the IEA is saying. I mean, you hear the criticisms of, oh, it's completely unrealistic. Why are they saying we don't need any more investment? Now, what people don't seem to understand, although basically says it in black and white in the WEO documentation, is if you want to achieve net zero, this is what you're going to have to do. And the only criticism I think that we should make of the IEA is, well, OK, guys, but is your net zero scenario the lowest cost one? Or can we think of scenarios which would actually achieve the same thing at lower cost? And I think very few people, no one as far as I know, has addressed that issue satisfactorily. We've addressed a couple of bits of it in OIES. But let me address your second question. Has gas reached its peak? No, I don't think it has. I think it's reached its peak in Europe, at least unabated gas has reached its peak in Europe. But in Asia, I think that we'll see that continue. Gas is only really just starting to get going in Africa. There's a lot of resource holders that want to develop their gas resources. The big question really is, to what extent will those who are increasing their natural gas demand be able to and willing to go for abatement, whether it be CCS or whatever it's going to be? Or will they just basically take the view, well, you know, we'll kind of get around to this when we get around to it? Now, some of those countries have quite challenging targets. So it'll be interesting to see, for example, how Japan and Korea address those targets. But I would say that gas has at least another 5, potentially another 10 years globally to grow. After that, we have to be a lot more cautious in how we project this. And this, of course, goes to the very important point about whether long-term contracts for international gas projects, which go out, if those contracts go out for 15, 20, 25 years, how those fit with targets. But I'm not pessimistic, but I am critical of the fact that an industry that I think has really a potentially brilliant future moving into the transition, if it can get its act together on decarbonized gases, it's made what for me is a fairly slow start.
Okay, well, on that note, I think we should probably bring this to a close. I certainly hope the gas program will be around in 10 years' time to continue decovering what is a reasonably optimistic outlook you've given us there. But I guess I'll close by saying, firstly, congratulations on forming the gas program 20 years ago. Well done on still being part of the gas program after all those years. And we'll look forward to hearing more or reading more and hearing more from you on podcasts and in paper over the next decade as well, I hope. So, Jonathan, thank you very much indeed for your time today. Thanks to all our listeners. Hope you've enjoyed this slightly extended podcast as we've reviewed the last two decades of the global gas market. There'll be another podcast from the gas program in a couple of weeks' time. But until then, thank you very much indeed for listening. Take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.